State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order. First item on the agenda today is the overview of the Attorney General's Office and the appropriation request.
Okay, well, very good. Madam Chair and members of the committee, good morning, and thank you for having me. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the Attorney General's Office today with all of you. Madam Chair, when I visited with you recently, you asked me to bring along a picture.
Yes.
And so I did. I brought along a picture of this lady right here who I keep in my desk drawer. And her name is Gail Nelson. Gail, there we go. I keep it in my drawer. Gail Nelson was from Iron, Minnesota. She worked in Duluth, which a town you know well, Madam Chair. And Gail had one arm, and because of her one arm, her job opportunities were really limited. But she was able to get a job in Duluth signing envelopes and helping to address envelopes. Well, Gail developed cancer, and it was cancer of the ovaries. And she got very, very sick, and she had coverage under Minnesota Care, but it was only about $10,000 of hospital coverage, and she burned through that very, very quickly with the $10,000 limit. And she, I think, must have ultimately incurred over $75,000 in medical bills. Well, Gail wrote to the Attorney General's office asking for help, and she said that with these $75,000 in medical bills, the debt collectors were just pounding her something fierce to pay these bills and were coming at her and coming at her and calling her at all hours of the day and the night, and they were calling her at work, and at one point harassed her so bad that she left work crying and had to drive an hour home to Iron, Minnesota. And she finally, after this continual hounding and calling and pounding her, got so desperate, she wrote to the Attorney General's office, and I'll never forget what she said. She said in that letter to the Attorney General's office, short of killing myself, I don't know what to do to get these people to stop badgering me. Well, it was ultimately Gail Nelson's story that got our office involved in sitting down with every hospital in the state of Minnesota, and we entered into agreements. It was a forward-thinking agreement where every hospital on the front end agreed to charge patients the same price when they're uninsured that they charge to the government or insurance companies for the same services. And then on the back end, they agreed to put better controls in place over outside debt collectors so that hopefully the next patients coming forward wouldn't be subject to those kind of tactics. And those agreements were entered into, and I think were really, really successful for the state and successful for patients in this state. And, you know, the reason I keep Gail's picture in my desk is it's people like Gail that all of us work for. Every single one of us as elected officials, that's why we're here. We all have stories of Gail's in our areas that we serve and that we work for. And so that's why I brought Gail's picture today, because it's what I think this is all about for each one of us here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So, you know, thank you for having me. I know you have on this committee and as public officials a difficult job. We continue to face budget pressures, and you have a lot of decisions to make and a lot of difficult things on your plate that you're continually grappling with. In terms of the Attorney General's office, what we do is we provide legal representation to over 100 state agencies and boards and commissions and public officials. In any given year, we have over 7,000 open legal files, so that can range from a slip and fall. You know, somebody leaves and we fall down because the Capitol, as we see this morning, wasn't shoveled very well and somebody sues the state, then we're the law firm, if you will, that would represent the state of Minnesota in that litigation, to very major constitutional challenges that are very protracted. The litigation that we handle is complicated, it's sophisticated. We regularly go up against not just the biggest law firms and the best lawyers in the state of Minnesota, but in fact in the entire country. We serve a variety of functions. We defend the laws that you write. So if there's a constitutional challenge and somebody sues the state of Minnesota over the constitutionality of a law, then we defend the laws that you write, helping to give meaning and voice to the policy decisions made by the legislature. I'll give you an example of that. 2 years ago, the legislature passed a pension reform law to deal with the cost of living adjustments, and some retirees sued the state of Minnesota and tried to declare that action of the legislature unconstitutional. And then we in the Attorney General's office represented the state and defended that decision and ultimately succeeded in defending it, and the court ruled that wasn't a retroactive impairment of contract. To say the campaign finance laws right now, the disclosure laws that this body has passed are under constitutional challenge, and we're in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals defending the campaign disclosure laws right now. We also enforce the laws that you write. We handle enforcement proceedings for all of the state agencies. If they want to bring a court action or a legal action, then we're the ones who bring that action, as well as directly enforce a number of laws ourselves, where authority is vested in the Attorney General's office. That work then helps to protect the health and safety and economic security of Minnesota citizens, and also helps to bring money back into the state treasury. We defend the state of Minnesota when it's sued in litigation. The state is a deep pocket, and when you're a deep pocket and there are money, the state of Minnesota is often sued in various cases. And so when the state sued, then we're the shop that defends the state in that litigation. Last year, we estimate we saved over $500 million by defending the state in a variety of different lawsuits that are filed. And to give put our budget in perspective, I think our general fund appropriation is about $21 million a year. We also, in a variety of different ways, protect the state's legal interests in court. To give you an example of that, the 35W bridge fell down. You all passed a special compensation fund to compensate victims, paid $37 million into a fund so that those victims wouldn't have to on their own file lawsuits against the state when they died and were injured due to no fault of their own. And then you also charged the Attorney General's office with the task of going out and trying to get some of that money back, and we did. We were involved in a variety of different lawsuits with the designer of the bridge, the contractor on the bridge, with various other companies, and I think at one point counted something like 27 lawyers on the other side of all of that bridge litigation, and ultimately brought claims and achieved settlements that brought then some of that money back into the state of Minnesota. And then in the area of public safety, we do a variety of functions, one of which is to assist rural county attorneys in our rural areas on certain prosecutions and criminal appeals. Up in Monoman County, when a deputy, Dewey, a sheriff deputy, was shot and killed, 27 years old, died from that wound, Monoman County Attorney's Office was a very small shop and asked us for expert assistance, and we were able to come in and assign a prosecutor to help try that. The loss of a public officer in the line of duty is an offense against every single Minnesotan, and we were able to help bring that case. In terms of our budget, I like to thank the Attorney General's office and that we have been a very good steward of the public tax dollar and that we're a highly efficient agency. We passed out, I think, a chart showing our budget. It looks something like this, and you can see the appropriations from the general fund have substantially reduced over the last 10 or so years. In 2001, our general fund budget was $28.8 million. Last year it was $21 million. So in actual dollars, that's a reduction of about close to $8 million in a dozen years, or 27%. And in adjusted dollars, when you adjust for inflation, that's more like a 42% cut over the last 10 years or so. Our staffing levels have shrunk too. I think in 1998, the office had over 250 attorneys. Now we have under 130 attorneys. So it's almost a cut in about half of number of attorneys over a period of about 15 years or so. And then when you compare the Attorney General's budget, say, to other public law firms in the state of Minnesota, we handed out one more chart here that kind of shows our budget. If you add our general fund appropriation plus our other funding, our budget's about $34 million a year. And keep in mind, we're a law firm for the entire state of Minnesota, which is 87 counties. You can compare that to Ramsey County, which is $2 million more than us, and that's just one county. Or you compare the Attorney General's budget to Hennepin County, which is $43 million at just one county. So I think that kind of puts the size of our budget into some perspective. In terms of where our budget is allocated, it's people. You know, we don't have programs that we operate or parks that we operate. We're a service agency, and it's basically people and bodies. A little over 80% of our budget is personnel. A big chunk then is leases, you know, the rental space and so on, and leases. And then the remaining 10% or so is what you need to operate a public law firm, everything from Westlaw to service of process companies, Metro Legal, law books, things that you need to run a public law firm. As I mentioned, I think we deliver a good bang for the buck for the work that we do. Of course, our work ultimately is measured in the lives of people like Gail and how much people like Gail have perhaps a little bit better life and that we're a stronger, safer, better place to live because of our work. But even when you translate that into dollars, we're revenue positive for the state. In calendar year 2012, as I mentioned, we estimate that our legal work defending claims against the state exceeded $500 million, so people wanted that money from the state, and we defended the state in that litigation and resulted in not paying out that money that people otherwise wanted, and judgments, positive judgments of over $40 million, where the state then, through the legal work, obtained judgments and brought money then back into the general treasury. So that is a quick overview of our office. It's an important office. I think the legal work is important, again, in the impact on people's lives, and also just the legal work helps to give effect and carry out the laws that all of you write. So I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I appreciate all of you for your public service. I know your issues are many and varied, and you have a lot of things on your plate, and really appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you today.
Thank you very much, Attorney General Swanson. Could you tell us about how many cases does your Consumer Affairs Department deal with in a year? That's the one that I think many of us are familiar with, and oftentimes when someone comes to us, we say, well, contact the Attorney General's office.
Sure. Yeah, Madam Chair, I know on any given day we get hundreds of complaints in our office, and we have to sift through those complaints and try to investigate them, look into them. They range the gamut on topics. It can be things that impact people's lives and can have a huge impact on people's lives. And then from that, we sort of sift through them, and ultimately some of them turn into court actions, some turn into settlements. I didn't bring with me a hard count of how many, but it's a lot of activity that has really impacted people. I will tell you, in a tough economy, that you see more and more scams, taking advantage of people for a variety of reasons. I think that in a bad economy, when people have trouble maybe finding a job themselves, they look toward maybe bending the law and taking money from other people deceptively. And we've seen a host of cottage industries pop up here in the difficult economy that didn't even exist several years ago. For example, as we've had a foreclosure and housing crisis in our state, we've seen, I don't know how many companies that we've sued, probably close to 20, where they say, hey, pay me $2,000, $3,000, I'll modify your home mortgage, I'll deal with your mortgage lender for you, and then you find a way to maybe borrow the money, and they don't deal with your mortgage lender, they take the $2,000 or $3,000, take it, basically steal it. Now you're left in a worse position because you thought you had an advocate and did everything right to get assistance, and then they take the money and run. We've seen that in all kinds of different areas. Timeshares, pay me $2,000, I'll help you sell your timeshare. And then they don't help you sell your timeshare. But all of that is, I think, very much a sign of the times. And then as well as our citizens have been squeezed and the elderly have been squeezed financially, perhaps it can create more susceptibility to some of these scams. If you're in a very tough financial situation and you're living on that limited Social Security check and somebody comes along with an offer that sounds good, perhaps it's more tempting in a bad economy. And so for that reason, the work has varied and has definitely been on the uptick here in recent years just because of the sign of the financial times in which we live.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Attorney General,
yes.
My notes at least, the governor's been recommending no increase for 2014-15 for your budget. We're going to devote a portion of our committee time today to House File 95, which is a bill to ratify or approve the state employees' contracts. I'll have two questions, Madam Chair. And the first one is, what portion of your employees would in your department or agency would be covered by the state employees' contracts?
Attorney General.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I think the portions in our office who would be covered by those contracts would essentially be our clerical staff, our support staff. So I'm just flipping through my book to get a number, but perhaps it's somewhere in the neighborhood of a third.
A third.
Something like that. It would be a rough guess.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, my next question, I guess, would be then, in order to accommodate the increase, mm-hmm. are you going to see your staff decline, or how are you going to take the added expense out of your budget to accommodate for the increase that they'll see?
Ms. Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I appreciate that question. You know, we put in a flat budget because that's what we were asked to do by MMB. To the extent that there is cost of living, you know, insurance increases or the contracts are changed, I mean, we would ask for that accommodation to be able to deal with whatever the cost of living adjustments are. But at the time, our former director of administration was putting together the budget. My understanding is she was asked to put it in flat, and we did that, trying to, be sensitive to the needs of the legislature.
Follow up, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
One last question then.
Yeah.
So the budget, as we understand it now, being flat, you'll come back in and ask for additional funds for that budget in order to accommodate these increases that we see in the contract?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, that would be correct.
All right, thank you.
And Representative Benson, keep in mind that constitutional officers do not have to even present their requests to the governor's office. Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman and Attorney General, as always, I think I remember the fights much more than the conclusions or what happened.
Yes.
But at one point, there was a discussion, maybe a couple of attorney generals ago,
mm-hmm.
about when you won money through litigation and
yes.
so forth, that it went into your budget instead of the general fund. What's happened with that?
Attorney General Swanson.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, basically any money that we recover in litigation by virtue of civil penalties or fines goes to the state treasury. It does not come to the Attorney General's office. We don't keep any fines or any recoveries. The money that we recover in litigation goes back to the general treasury.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chairman, I don't want to object to that as a general principle of budgeting. But I think that's maybe something that we ought to look at when we're looking, because that clearly isn't in our, that's not in any budget forecast, is it? Or it's not in any, we're not attributing that for anything. And I think in some sense, you know, to encourage litigation activities, but to recognize that they do cost money, and then to cost more money to expand them. At some point, I think we ought to look at some reappropriation of some of that funding. I think in Attorney General Humphrey's case, of course, it was a huge amount. We were looking at the tobacco settlements and so forth. But I think that's a little bit of financing that we ought to look at. I don't know if the Attorney General has any opinion on it.
Representative, Ms. Roberts, was Representative Kahn saying that it's no one gets to count that?
Well, I didn't quite say that. I don't think we get to, Madam Chair, if I can just interject, I don't think we get to anticipate that and put it into forecasts and that kind of stuff.
But ways and means must.
Well, Madam Chair and members, to the extent that there is some known settlement that's going to be coming, that would be included in the forecast on the bottom line of the general fund. I'm not sure if there's any ability to capture something that we don't know about that might happen. So I'm not sure what the question.
No, I guess following up on
Representative
Madam Chairman, following up on the information, I'd like to know, is it, does it just kind of go into the bottom of the general fund, or do we specifically see it in some kind of a line item to the general fund?
Mr. Shepherd, you were shaking your head. I thought you had something to Attorney General Swanson, anything to add?
Madam Chair, yeah, I mean, I think what happens is, so if we file a lawsuit and get a recovery, eventually then the recovery is deposited in the general fund, but I don't know if it's really booked or anticipated or even knowing what the recovery will be until we actually win the court, win a trial, get a settlement, and then at such time as it happens, it just flows through right into the Treasury. So I think to Representative Kahn's point, I don't know that it's necessarily recognized ahead of time that this money is coming in or these are the recoveries. And as I mentioned, I think that speaks to or goes to the efficiency of our office and that we are saving money every day and then also bringing money in that helps offset the budget.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Attorney General.
Yes.
You know, you said you provide assistance to county attorneys when they need that, when requested. Mm-hmm. My question would be is, how do you decide whether you're going to provide that assistance to that county? And maybe in another way to ask that is, mm-hmm. what criteria do you use to determine whether you're going to provide that assistance or not?
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Howe, so we provide assistance out of the 87 counties to probably about 80 of them. We typically don't provide much assistance to the metro area county attorneys, so it'll be the county attorneys in rural Minnesota that we typically provide the assistance to. There are different areas where we provide it. Some are prosecutions, so it could, for example, be a direct homicide or prosecution where we might send an experienced prosecutor to help try the case. I mentioned, for example, the Deputy Dewey shooting of the Monoman County Sheriff Deputy, or down in Waseca County, you might recall the farmhouse shooting of the Kruger family where a mother and a child were shot late at night by a meth addict. Those would be examples of that. We provide assistance on appeals, and so if a conviction that was obtained by a county attorney is appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals or the Minnesota Supreme Court, we might provide assistance on that case. There are some appeals where you know, we look at the state needs and is it a statewide impact, is it a serious matter. Tend not to do it on misdemeanor cases or cases involving what's called sufficiency of the evidence, where the lawyer who tried the case is going to be familiar with the record and there's not a lot that we can add. We provide assistance in the area of sex offender civil commitments. So that work really spiked about 10, 12 years ago after the Drew Shadeen incident with Rodriguez. And so that's a case where somebody then has served their time and now they're going to be getting out, and the issue is bringing a commitment proceeding to commit them to St. Peter or Moose Lake, and that's an area we provide a lot of assistance on. And then in the area of Medicaid fraud, vulnerable adults, senior citizens who may have been ripped off by a guardian, for example, we can provide assistance there. We can't provide assistance in every case, though. As I mentioned, there was a time in our office where we used to have, you know, over 250 lawyers, and as I mentioned, we've got under 130 today, so we've got about half the number of lawyers we had 15 years ago. And so we look at a variety of different factors. What's the workload of the office at any given time? So what is the capacity of the office? We might look at the size of the office. There are some county attorneys that are a little bit bigger, and they've got more ability to handle cases on their own. In other cases, there are some county attorneys that are one- or two-person shop. You've got the elected county attorney and maybe one assistant. We look at the ability of the county to handle the case. There are some counties where they haven't had a homicide in 30, 40 years. Down in Rock County, where there was a killing in the Blue Mountain State Park, I think that county hadn't had a killing or a homicide in about 30 or 40 years, and I think it was just a tiny little office, maybe with one or two people. So that would be a case where we say, okay, we probably send a prosecutor in. We look at being able to try to fairly allocate our work around the state. The assistance we provide to rural county attorneys is a form of local government aid, if you will. I mean, the money passes through the Attorney General's budget, and then as a way of aiding local communities, the legislature has determined that's something that we would do, and so we try to fairly allocate it. And so one criteria or factor is how much assistance a particular county is giving. We try to share our aid or share our assistance, and so there are some counties that we've provided a lot of assistance to, and it may be then we can provide less in the future in order to help another particular county. And what's the magnitude of the problem? I mean, how significant of a problem is it? And what are the facts? I mean, there are some homicide prosecutions, for example, that are very straightforward. There are some homicide prosecutions that are very, very complicated, and you're looking at bringing in experts and forensic scientists and so on. So it's a case-by-case determination. And then we have lawyers who are cross-trained. I mean, we have lawyers who can handle both appeals, and they can handle sex offender commitment trials. And so part of it will be the workload, you know, at any given point in the office and where those lawyers are assigned and what their duty assignments are.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to follow that up, is once you determine that you're not going to assist the county, mm-hmm. is there any appeal that they can go through, or where do they go from there? There's no place they can turn to for assistance then?
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, there is our levels of assistance on cases can vary. And so, for example, in a case, there are some cases where if we're going to provide assistance, we actually go all the way right from beginning to end. If it's a homicide prosecution, for example, we'll handle every proceeding along the way and actually sit there at counsel table and try the case. In other cases, it may be other assistance, what type of search warrants are needed, or we might provide assistance on evidentiary motions. And so it's not really an all or nothing on even an individual case. So you may have a particular case where we provide a variety of levels of assistance depending on what the needs are. The kind of the law enforcement on the criminal side is constantly working together, and you have the federal authorities, U.S. attorney can get involved in a lot of these cases. And so part of what factors in as well is what level of activity is there going to be out of the U.S. attorney's office. Counties will routinely help each other. And so part of our kind of system of, you know, local, state, and federal enforcement is you have counties that might lend aid to one another. Counties will pitch in and help each other. There was a county attorney up in northeastern Minnesota who was shot in the line of duty, and we ended up providing help in that case to prosecute the fellow who shot him. So the defendant who shot him while he was in the courthouse and shot others. And then as well, several county attorneys in that case, such as Anoka County, pitched in and also provided help on his ongoing cases when the county attorney shot and can't handle the case. A variety of counties stepped up and helped handle the regular workload. So it's continual give and take and dialogue and discussion.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi.
Hi. Carolyn
Fonson.
Hello.
A few money-related questions. First,
yeah.
Thanks for doing your work with a lot less over the last few years. I mean, I'm sure you would have rather had it otherwise, but I think that's something to be commended. You mentioned there were 130 attorneys. How
yeah.
many support staff, roughly? I mean, just ballpark.
Sure. Let me get that for you, Representative Simon. Probably somewhere between 70 and 80, I would say, clerical staff right now.
And then, Madam Chair, in terms of the attorney divisions, how many of your attorneys do criminal work, either trial or appellate, roughly? I mean, ballpark.
You know, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I don't know the exact number, but I'm guessing in the neighborhood of 20, give or take,
yeah.
several on either side.
And, Madam Chair, I know that a few years ago there were some, I know it's always a little bit complicated when you're representing agencies,
mm-hmm.
they do some certain work in-house,
mm-hmm.
certain work that your office, the Attorney General's office, has traditionally done.
Yeah.
Is there any trend there? Are you taking on more agency cases, or are agencies, as some were doing a few years ago, starting to take more stuff in-house, or
mm-hmm.
is there just not a trend either way?
Madam General.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, I would say, in general, the work of the office is up, and again, part of that is the sign of the times I mentioned. So, you know, in the consumer area, it's up because of the scams and the level of activity. But that carries through to the agencies as well. You know, in a bad economy, you see more corner cutting, more shoddy practices. You know, in a bad economy, people don't get maybe the licenses they should have. And so whether it's, you know, building contractors not getting a license before they build a deck on somebody's house to, you know, somebody not having workers' comp insurance on their employees. When you have financial stress, that is stress throughout the system. And so the litigation has, I think, kept pace with that in terms of enforcement. The other trend I would note, Madam Chair and Representative Simon, is just the nature of litigation nowadays is so protracted. It's changed. It is knockdown, drag out, protracted litigation. As I mentioned on the 35W Bridge litigation, I think we counted 27 lawyers representing a variety of different defendants. And that's not unusual in our cases to very much see our lawyers, you know, having, you know, a few. And then on the other side, many, many. And the litigation that we do see, it goes on. I mean, it is just more protracted. You see more motions. You see battles on discovery. And that is something that has, I think, changed a lot over, you know, the course of that 15 years.
Representative Simon.
One more, Madam Chair. I know that for many years, the salaries of the attorneys at the Attorney General's office really did lag behind other public law offices, Hennepin, Ramsey, U.S. attorneys. Is it more equalized now, or is it still the case that you've, you know, kind of, those other public law offices have outpaced in terms of the salary?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, the other public law offices have outpaced the salaries in the Attorney General's office. You know, our first and foremost competitors for attorneys would be the private bar, and in the private bar, attorneys make anywhere from 3 to 10 times what they make in our office, and so ours is a case where the private sector is makes substantially more, and the lawyers that our lawyers go up against are making substantially more. As well, though, in the public law offices, no, our salaries have not kept pace. I think in the U.S. Attorney's Office, salaries tap out at $155,000. About half the lawyers make that. I think that when you look at the county attorney offices, at least in the metro area, the salaries in the Attorney General's Office have not kept pace with those either, as well as some of the salaries of lawyers who might be employed in other branches of the government. Our salaries are not have not kept up with that.
Representative Freiberg.
Pass.
Representative Denver.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Attorney General Swanson. What we've seen in the news quite a bit the last few weeks at the federal level, and also we'll probably see some legislation coming through here. And I think we all can agree that one of the roles of government is public safety. Has your agency been involved in any type of legislation coming up in terms of the any gun legislation, and what do you think your role is in, on that?
Madam Chair,
quickly,
Representative
Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, at this point not. I mean, we have an extensive sort of vetting process we do with regard to all legislative bills. One piece of legislation I have been strongly advocating for in the area of public safety, though, is a piece of guardianship legislation that will probably come before all of your committees. We have, I think, 25,000 people right now in Minnesota who are under guardianship or conservatorship. So these are people who judges have determined they can't care for themselves and that they can't function on their own. And our background check process has not kept pace with just the need for guardians. And when you look at the aging demographics, something like 10,000 baby boomers in this country, I think, every day are heading toward retirement. And so we've got a lot of seniors now. We're going to have a lot more. We saw a case in our office where there was a woman, Terry Haugie was her name, and she was deemed unfit to be a lawyer for lying and cheating with clients, and stripped of her ability to practice law, yet thereafter she was appointed in many, many cases, maybe as many as 200 cases by courts around the state to be a guardian and care for others. Well, once appointed, then she ended up stealing from those people, and that would be an example of something where we have been involved very much advocating and pushing for changing the background check laws, instead of 5 years, having them be every 2 years, instead of you know, not looking at things like licensing board actions. I think we should be looking toward, have they ever been disbarred as a lawyer or lost an insurance agent license? So that'd be one example. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for sticking by my request for the time limit on your presentation. It was our questions that drew us out.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you all for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you for what you do.
Second item on the agenda is the review of the Governor's Recs for Public Finance Authority. And members, we are going to complete our agenda today. And if we don't complete it in the time frame between now and 2 o'clock, we will come back at 6:45 tonight in this room. And I have scheduled every Monday this room for every Monday night in the future, so that Monday's schedules will always be complete on the day that we set the agenda. Thank you very much, Mr. Freeman. You gave us a brief introduction during the, or brief overview during the introductions in the past, and so we just want to hear the rest of the budget that you that we have to peruse before we can make appropriations. And your budget is a little bit different because we don't make many appropriations to it.
No. Yes. Madam Chair and members, thank you. Again, my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. Sometimes our name gets a little mixed up. It's not a, doesn't easily roll off the tongue sometimes. But you should have a packet in that looks like this with our little PFA logo at the top. And I know time is tight, and I won't go through all of this, but the first page kind of covers in brief the PFA and what we are. And essentially what the Public Facilities Authority is an independent state agency that serves as an infrastructure bank for local governments, primarily for water infrastructure projects, both wastewater, drinking water infrastructure, also some stormwater infrastructure. We are governed by a board of six commissioners representing the agencies of employment and economic development, management and budget, health, agriculture, transportation, and the pollution control agency. And we administer programs in conjunction with each of those agencies. For our programs, our partner agencies, for the most part, specifically Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department, are responsible for setting project priorities, conducting technical environmental reviews of projects, and then they certify those projects to us for funding. And the PFA staff conduct the credit reviews and set loan terms and conditions. Most of the funding we provide is through low-interest loans through our revolving loan funds. We service those loans and provide the overall program and financial administration. We also work real hard with local governments to help them understand the various programs, the financing requirements, as well as their local responsibilities for the projects. PFA has authority to sell up to $1.5 billion in AAA or in tax-exempt revenue bonds. Our PFA bonds are rated AAA by all three rating agencies. These are our revenue bonds. They're strictly repaid by loan repayments and interest earnings of the PFA. There's no state backing to these bonds. They're totally separate from the state's general obligation bonds. We have about $1.1 billion outstanding. The PFA right now has total assets of about $2.3 billion. We receive no state general fund appropriations for program administration. Our administrative funds come primarily from fees on loan repayments and a small amount of set-asides on the federal funds that we receive. In total, our administrative expenses are about 1% of the total financing we provide. We're a small office. We have 8 FTEs. We do receive some support functions from DEED, and we also provide funding to the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department for their technical responsibilities in conjunction with administering the PFA programs. On the back side of the first sheet is a very quick summary of PFA programs. Our largest program, the Clean Water Revolving Fund, is low-interest loans. To date, we've made about $2.5 billion of loans since 1989. Last year, we made about $139 million in loans to communities, big and small, all over the state. This program operates with some program equity. There's federal capitalization grants on an annual basis, and the state provides a 20% match. We've received that 20% match through state general obligation bond proceeds appropriated to the PFA for that revolving fund. And then we also have the Wastewater Infrastructure Funding Program, the WIF program, which is supplemental assistance grants for high-cost projects in hardship communities. The grants are awarded based on affordability criteria. Those funds also come through state bonding appropriations. The 2012 bonding bill appropriated $15 million for the WIF program, and we've now, all of those funds have been awarded or reserved for projects that are either under construction now or will be under construction in this coming year. And then there are Clean Water Legacy Fund programs, and those do have, Madam Chair, a governor's request for funds from the dedicated Clean Water Legacy Funds, and I'll talk more about that specific item in a minute. I'll just continue the at the bottom of the page. We have a Drinking Water Revolving Fund, operates very similarly to the Clean Water Program that I described. We have a Small Transportation Revolving Fund where that we partner with MnDOT. Primarily, we only do about two or three projects a year. That's a much smaller program, primarily provides financing to local governments for their local share of a larger project, and also a credit enhancement program, which isn't any, doesn't not provide direct financing, but it's a state backing of local GO bonds for specific purposes. Our budget request, the next page then, which has the Legacy Fund logo at the top, Clean Water Legacy Fund programs. The PFA has three programs that have been funded through the Clean Water Legacy Fund, and you can see those programs and the governor's request for 14 and 15, $18 million for the TMDL grant program and $4 million for the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program. The TMDL grant program provides 50% grants for eligible costs up to $3 million to assist municipalities to implement wastewater and stormwater projects when they're required to provide treatment, additional treatment over and above what they would otherwise have to do do their share of the cleanup of an impaired water. The TMDL, Total Maximum Daily Load, is a study that the Pollution Control Agency does focused on a particular water body, the sources of pollutants to that water body, and then they do an implementation plan that may require cities as well as other polluters or sources of pollution to take certain steps. With respect to cities, those steps are written into their permits and become legal requirements that the cities have to meet. This program helps cities meet those additional costs with the 50% grants. You can see grants awarded in 2012, applications that we currently have for this year. The funds, as with all of our programs, we don't award the grant or loan funds until the project has been fully approved, has bid, and is ready to start construction. At the bottom of the page, you'll see some proposed technical amendments. We do hope to have a bill soon. We're looking at making some minor changes to these programs to kind of simplify the process and make them work a little better, make them more effective. And the first and real major change, or the biggest change, is to make the funds available to communities when they're required to do this additional treatment levels, even if the TMDL implementation plan hasn't been approved yet. So it the TMDL process is a long process. Cities know it, and in some cases the PCA may implement requirements through the permit prior to a TMDL, or in some cases maybe a TMDL wouldn't be done. We'd like to try to make these funds available to communities anytime they're being asked to go over and above what they would otherwise have to do. And one of those changes also, the second bullet, is the phosphorus reduction program right now, or phosphorus reduction projects. Right now, that's was created as a separate program. It really is sort of just a subset of the kind of projects we do with the TMDL grant program. And so as you can see, we've requested $0 for that program. We do have some current applications, but what we'd like to do is essentially merge those two programs into one. So again, the bottom line is to try to streamline and simplify that program. The backside of that page talks about that phosphorus reduction grant program that I mentioned. This is for when cities are being required to treat for phosphorus at a greater level than they would otherwise have to meet, specifically when they're required to treat to 1 milligram or per liter or less for phosphorus on their wastewater discharge. You can see the projects that there's a small number of projects in this program, and it will, we believe, mesh real easily into that other program, and that'll simplify things both for us and for the cities. Small community wastewater program is a little bit different. That program is focused on very small, unsewered communities that are experiencing serious problem, environmental and public health problems from failing septic systems. This program focuses on those where, ideally, if there's failing septic systems, the solution of choice would be for private landowners to fix their own private individual septic system. But in some small communities, little crossroads communities where the lots are too small, soils are poor, there's many of these scattered throughout the state, and they're too far away from a larger community to easily hook up to a larger municipal system. So this program really looks at how can we do something small, relatively inexpensive, to fix those health and environmental problems in the cheapest way possible. What we're finding is the reason they've been problems for, in some cases, quite some time, is there aren't really any real simple answers. And so there is a technical assistance component to this program that helps the community look at what the problems are and try to find a feasible solution that's also something they can afford. And then there's construction financing that follows up with that. Our technical amendment bill will make some changes to provide a little more on the technical assistance side and adjust the construction funding to be a little more effective for these projects. And then I'm going real quick, but I'd be happy to answer any questions. But on the next page, then, the green sheets, and I gave you a little taste of this when I was here the last time, this illustrates the clean water project priority list, 330 projects or so, I believe, for about $1.3 billion. This list is ranked by the Pollution Control Agency based on criteria in their rules, environmental and public health criteria. Projects are ranked 1 through, as I mentioned, 300 and some. We don't actually provide funding, as I mentioned, until the project's ready to go to construction. And so when you see a light gray line all the way across the sheet, those projects have been funded, and they're now under construction. In some cases, there's only a cell that's highlighted indicating there's certain statutory criteria where a project's met, funds are reserved, and they're working on completing the engineering process so that they can be ready for construction. The legacy programs, just want to illustrate, in the middle under PFA financing programs, there's the columns kind of middle right, clean water legacy programs. Those are the particular programs that I've talked about with the budget request for the next biennium. This illustrates the projects that have applied for this year's funds. So that when there's a dollar in that column, they have an application in with us. They're working on the engineering design documents and environmental review. And once the project is approved and certified by the Pollution Control Agency, then we'll be ready for construction and we can make that grant award. And what we do is typically those grants are packaged with loans from our revolving loan fund. In some cases, also the WIF grants when there's affordability problems. We also work with other funders to the right of the page. USDA Rural Development provides funding for small rural communities. We partner with them as well as other programs that are listed there too. A lot of times the funding that we provide is a package of various funding sources that a community might be eligible for. And with that, I'll stop. And
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of questions on your page that does have the Clean Water Legacy logo on it. And I didn't hear if you did. It didn't register with me, so I just want to follow up with you if I could. Your funding may come from more than one source. In other words, not just the legacy funds, is that correct?
Correct, Madam Chair, Representative. The Clean Water Revolving Fund loan is not legacy dollars. The WIF grant program are not legacy dollars. Those are totally separate. So these three project or programs are the only ones that actually receive the legacy funds.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just looking at rough numbers here, $33 million in FY12-13 and FY14-15 at $22 million. You discussed the phosphorus program. Would you be pursuing money from other sources? Need not there? I just guess I'm wondering what the differential is on the numbers here. You explained the phosphorus, but I'm just not sure about the other two.
Director Freeman.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. We asked for a lower amount for the TMDL grant program really because at this point the projects, there's not enough demand to take additional dollars. We don't fund until they're ready to go to construction. There's a lot of times it's a long lead-in process, sometimes several years before a project's actually ready for construction. The other thing is the money that was appropriated last biennium did allow, similar to bonding appropriations, it did allow those funds to be available for 5 years because of that long lead-in time, and cities kind of need to know the money is available mm-hmm. so that they can make the investments in the engineering and the other things that they have to do. So we do still have some money available from the current biennium. And based on the projects that we see coming, we estimated that we wouldn't need as much, $18 million for the two-year period, as what we think would be adequate to meet the demand.
Thank you. Director Freeman, on the green sheets, this doesn't have anything to do with budget so much, but the projects that are in gray, they're going to get funded for sure. Are they the only ones that are going to get funded?
Madam Chair, all of the projects that have a dollar amount shown under kind of just to the right of estimated project cost, it starts to illustrate the programs and the various dollars. Those are the dollars that would be available for the project when they're ready to start construction, with the exception of the column that says right in the middle, with grant estimated need. That would, those funds would have to come from a future bonding appropriation. So the, but other than that, all of the other funds shown are there and available for those communities as soon as their project is ready to start construction. Specifically, the Clean Water Revolving Fund loan, the first column, all of those projects are on our current, it says 2013 IUP fundable range. IUP stands for intended use plan. That's the process that we use through a required by the EPA, and we make a list available to cities, and they know how to apply on the list, and then we can they apply for a certain amount, and those are the loan dollars, the low interest loan funds. We make those funds available. We don't have enough money to do everybody on the list. We draw a funding cutoff at 45 points, which I think is about page 4 or 5, where 45 points reaches to. And then, and we try to maintain that as a constant level from year to year, so cities, there's some predictability. They can plan ahead. A city knows if they're at 45 points or above, they've got a pretty good chance of at least being eligible for the loan funds in a future year when they're ready to go to construction. The other funds then are more dependent on appropriations.
Thanks.
We do we did only received a state match on the loan program from last year's bonding bill for 1 year of the 2 year request. So we do have a little problem on the future loan funds. We'll have to see how that works out. But otherwise, the loan program is a revolving fund, and we're able to do about $100 million a year through just the funds that revolve in that program, although we've got requests for about $200 to $300 million a year. So it's, that's why we use that priority list to help cities plan and decide who should be funded.
Seeing no one else with questions, thank you very much. Good luck in the Legacy Finance Committee.
Thanks.
House File 95. Representative Lilly.
Greetings, Madam Chair. I brought some... having served on your committee in the past, I brought some homework. So I brought a picture of that a constituent of mine has done. You can hold it. It's probably a little easier. Her name's Mary Stevens, and she lives in my district. And Mary had extreme health issues, and she moves around in a wheelchair and has PCAs that take care of her all the time. And I represent North St. Paul, and obviously we, well, not obviously, but the Snowman's our community icon or whatever. And I asked her one time to make this for me, but she pushes a button. I mean, often we think we have a tough life at times, and she pushes a button and says, "Hi, my name is Mary," and that's how we converse. It's all typed in and other things like that. So I guess that's, I went down past Representative Benson's district when for college down to Luther, and they really stressed Matthew. So I think that's probably why I'm a liberal. I don't know.
Well, please tell your constituent that I really like her snowman, especially because the snowman is smiling and it's a bright, happy day.
Right. If you were to come to my, Madam Chair and members, if you were to come to my office, you would see quite a bit of her art and other snowmen as well. But thank you for having us today.
I will make my way to your office.
Madam Chair and members, House File 95, I'm very excited to bring to you today. We've had a couple stops already. We were seen in the Jobs Committee, and we were... And now we're we had a little theatrics on the House floor, and now we're with you folks, and we're going to go to Ways and Means and hopefully to the floor at some point. But this bill essentially ratifies the contracts, the labor agreements between many of our state workers that currently serve in the administration. It sounds like they're all across the street in Governor Dayton's office, but they're not. That's administration is the work groups that are covered, that MMB negotiates, and its workers all around the state. And so the big contracts are with them, and it's thousands of workers that are impacted by these contracts. And so essentially last year those contracts were ratified after session, and we had an opportunity to ratify them during the summer in the subcommittee of employee relations, which the contracts were voted down at that time. So now they're back again before us now that we're in session. So then it becomes a bill and goes through the legislative process to become law. And we also have other contracts that are catching up. With me today, I've got Mr. Hubinger, who's could explain it probably in more detail, and maybe he can add some thoughts to what I've left open.
Thank you, Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and staff to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. As Representative Lilly indicated, this bill would ratify five labor contracts. The initial contracts that were rejected by the subcommittee with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and with MAPE, the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. Those two unions alone represent about two-thirds of the state employees. After the subcommittee rejected those two contracts, MMB continued in negotiations and reached agreements with three other unions. And then they also completed development of two compensation plans for employees in the executive branch who are not represented by a union. And these two plans are known as the commissioner's plan, which does not cover commissioners but unclassified employees, and the managerial plan, which includes managers and bureau chiefs and that sort in the executive branch. There's a pattern to these contracts and plans. They provide for a 2% across-the-board increase in salary in January of 2013. They also provide for step increases or performance-based increases. These are increases that are based on an evaluation of an employee's performance. Employees are eligible for them roughly once per year. The amount of that step varies by the contract. They range, depending on the labor contract, between 2.7 and 3.5%. Only employees who are not at the top of their salary ranges are eligible for these increases, and about half of employees are not eligible for them. The other major fiscal item in the labor contracts are changes to the state employee group insurance program. The fiscal item in there is that the Joint Labor Management Committee and MMB agreed to changes in the co-pays and deductibles and co-insurance provisions, increasing each of them. These are items that a state employee or the dependent would pay when they're actually receiving services. These contracts have about a 1.5% impact in costs in this biennium. That adds up to about $76 million. That's for all funds. About a third of this would be in the general fund. MMB estimates that the impact of these contracts on the next biennium, on the 14-15 biennium, is about 4.9% at a cost of about $249 million. Madam Chair, that's a quick summary of the fiscal impacts of these contracts.
Thank you. I move that House File 95, First Engrossment, be recommended to pass and forwarded to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any further discussion? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think before you in your packages today, you have an amendment to the bill, 95A1. And Madam Chair, I've worked with Mr. Shepard before we started today, and I have an oral amendment to the amendment on page.
Do you all have A1 in your hands before you? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam
Oral
Chair.
Amendment.
And line 1.7, changing the fixed dollar amounts, so that the first one for individual coverage is, and insert there, 10% of the total monthly premium. And then after coverage, for family coverage, insert, cross out 150, the fixed amount, and insert 15% of the total monthly premium.
So after the word on page 1.7 for individual coverage
is
10% of total
of the total monthly premium, correct? And then after coverage and for the family coverage, 15% of the total monthly premium.
Proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and to the author, we spent a lot of time on this. I was part of the committee last year that when we took the vote, it didn't pass. I understand there's a new majority and your prerogative to move the bill through, and I can appreciate that. But for the rest of the members who may not have been part of that conversation, and I know that it has been through a committee or two already, one of the sticking points in terms of, at least for the Republican portion of the committee last year, is that we've gone through a terrible and difficult economic period for many Minnesotans, and when we take a look at the benefit packages that are available to people in the private sector, rarely, if any time, is there health insurance package that is allowed, that is given, that requires nothing in terms of the insurance premium pay of the employee. In fact, usually it is upwards to 50% of the monthly premium. And we thought it was prudent, considering the impact that this was having. And I know that we're short on time. We're going to have some discussions about what this will be or what this will mean in terms of the impact on the general fund budget. But this amendment just goes to the members of the House and the Senate, that if we're ever going to have a discussion that it does speak to, when we have these negotiations, realistically, to say, great compensation package, however, we think that you need to be part of this. And that, you know, I could have had testimony here today and chose not to, from people who say when you have skin in the game, the benefit, it usually means more, and you're more cognizant of, I have to pay for this, I'm not going to abuse it. But members, this would mean for us, at least, a leadership role in that discussion, that we would have some skin in the game. I don't think that probably most of the constituents who elected us, you, me, know that indeed that if we take the individual plan, it costs us nothing. And in a matter of full disclosure, so that everyone knows and it's on the record, I don't take the state health insurance plan. I opted to stay with my federal, believing that I needed to pay more, and I pay $300 a month for my family plan. So what I have before you is an opportunity for the members, of at least in this committee, to pass an amendment to House File 95 that commits us to a leadership role, not our staffs, not any other part of the any of the contracts, the employees that are covered by these contracts, but us, in saying we commit at least to the taxpayer that we feel like we need to be sharing in the cost and not taking that entire burden to the taxpayer. So that's the amendment, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Just real quickly to the amendment, and Madam Chair and members, and Representative Benson, I would just speak against it, and it's not necessarily on the merits of it. It's just, you know, you certainly were in session, and we could fully discuss this. You know, you're on this committee. You've had 2 years, you know, in the past, but certainly going forward, you know, there's all things that we, you know, can serve on a body and not necessarily get passed. So I'm sympathetic to that, you know, even if you're in charge. But so I'm not calling you out on that. I'm just saying, you know, you're on this committee going forward. It's good. This bill is a little different. You know, this is, just keep in mind, this is administration. This is not legislative. This is not our staff in this building. This isn't folks in the work in the Capitol. This, I mean, with our efforts, this is administration employees. So there is some separation, and I just think it's these contracts are long overdue, and you know, it's really time to move forward. And I'm not necessarily against Mr. Representative Benson to having this discussion, and I think you're being true to what you're saying, and I think we'll have plenty of opportunity to have that as we go forward into this session.
Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
Thank you. First, I'd like to ask for a roll call when we vote on the amendment. Unlike many of the others, I haven't planned anything for 6:45, or is it 5:45? So we could have more discussion if
it's
we needed
6:45.
To. 6:45. I think it's worth having that discussion, so I thank you. I would prefer that you just said, hey, it does make sense. This doesn't impact these contracts at all. Yes. In fact, as we move forward, this will not have any impact at all on any of the employees and the negotiators. This will simply have an impact on us taking some leadership role as we move forward in any further discussions. We may never have that discussion again, but we don't have a right to stand on anything if indeed we've not looked at our own plans and decided that we need to be part of helping the taxpayers of Minnesota. I did a very simple calculation. Minimally, it's probably $100,000 we'd be giving back to taxpayers. But it's the spirit of it, not the letter of it, that's important here. And that's why I think it's important that as a body, we make a determination that we need to be part of the solution.
Mr. Hubinger, was the legislative salaries negotiated in these discussions, in these contractual discussions? Was there anything about the legislature that was discussed or negotiated in any of the contractual discussions and agreements?
Madam Chair, these collective bargaining agreements and compensation plans only apply to employees in the executive branch, and they do not apply to legislative staff.
Or
legislators, except for to the extent that the legislature participates in the state employee insurance program. So the changes that are proposed in these contracts would also apply to members and staff of the legislature.
And I, Mr. Hubinger, I thought that the legislators, I don't remember the exact words that you said, to the extent that we're part of the health insurance program. But that is because the powers that be contract or purchase the health insurance program on our behalf. Is that not correct? Am I correct?
Madam Chair, under the legislature's statutes, the Legislative Coordinating Commission makes a determination about how to provide insurance for members and staff. And they've determined that the most efficient way to do that is by participating in the state employee group insurance program.
And when we...
Employee group insurance program.
And when we participate, we have to pay the copay. When the legislators participate in their health insurance package that the Legislative Coordinating Committee decide was most efficient, we have to pay the copays. And we have to pay all individuals have to pay the first $300?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So there is the same type, or there's the same program being offered than the legislators as to the employee groups.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Benson. I had a couple of questions, clarifications. But I want to thank you for your forthrightness in saying that, you know, this wouldn't directly impact you, and I appreciate that. It wouldn't directly impact me either. As a disabled veteran, the VA takes good care of me. But you talk about leading by example. Well, usually, my experience, you know, you walk the talk, and so you're talking about putting something on other folks that you ain't going to impact you. And I think that it doesn't sit right with me. Just so you know, I'm just going to speak against this. I think we all need to figure out how we're going to take care of our families and participate in health care, and I think we're going to get ourselves there eventually with universal single payer in this country, but that's a few years down the road. But I don't think that this is the way to go here, and at this time, I think we need to take it back and rethink it so that we got something that's fair to everybody that's sitting at the table here, and this is probably not the venue to do it. It doesn't sound like. I just want to speak against this amendment.
Representative Kahn.
Not on this amendment.
Representative Simon, on the amendment.
Yes, on the amendment, Madam Chair. And Representative Benson, thanks for the amendment. I think the spirit is great. You're right. Legislators should be part of the solution, not part of the problem. But as Representative Purcell alluded to, I think it ought to be voluntary and not compelled. And there are many other ways that legislators can help ease the state's burden. My guess, Representative Benson, is you may take some per diem. Maybe you or other folks can take less than you normally did. That would add up to $100,000 pretty quickly if 50 or 60 legislators took a little bit less. Or on the campaign side, my guess is you probably take the state subsidy, the campaign finance subsidy. You could give some of that back. You could give $1,000 or $2,000 back. If 50 legislators gave a couple thousand bucks back, we'd be at $100,000, the same number that you thought that this would raise. So there are many ways that legislators could give back voluntarily if the spirit moves them. I just don't know that we should put it in law, and certainly not this law, which is a state contract. So I'd urge a no vote.
Representative Benson.
Well, thank you. And Representative Purcell, if I were taking the state, I'd save $170 a month. I mean, that's the difference that I pay above what a typical family would hear that's in the legislature. So it's not like I'm not doing myself a favor. But the fact is that if the thing that we're trying to do is leadership, certainly we can't all take less in terms of per diem. And I think the Republicans in the last session worked that so that that's what happened. We all took a cut in our per diem. But this one steps out on something that we continue to see escalating prices in, health care. That does impact the general fund and does impact our taxpayers. So I think it is important that that we set and make a statement that we're going to be part of the solution.
Any other roll call? Ms. Melander?
Actually, Madam Chair.
Representative Kahn.
Can I just ask one question of Representative Benson?
Sure.
Just because I don't understand the system. Does your keeping the federal plan instead of switching to the state plan give you a little bit more security in terms of a possibility of not re-election?
No, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
No, it doesn't. In fact, I can opt in and out as a civil service retiree on the open seasons like anybody else could do it here.
Representative Kahn.
Maybe we should look at a change in federal law so that people make a decision to go one way or the other.
Not in this bill,
I understand.
Ms. Melander.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Newton?
No.
Representative Detmer?
Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
Representative Dean is absent. Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Howe?
No. Yes. Yes.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Crashaw?
Yes.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
No.
Representative Swatsky?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Wills?
Yes.
There are 8 yeses and 8 noes.
The amendment does not prevail. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do indeed hope that Representative Benson does bring his proposal as a form of a bill, and we hear the proposal. I ask for your support on this. I think these are modest increases. You know, I don't want to get into the politics of it all, but just can I just give you a quick summary of history, though? In 2006, this bill passed 131-1. 2010, 128-1. 2010, 118-5. And then last year, it wasn't ratified. So I just hope as a body that we can just, I'm not sure that this is where we want to fight with our, to do our politics. I think we can all engage in politics and, you know, we, you know, our, the people that are keeping us safe, you know, that our prison workers or whatnot are, you know, keeping our highways plowed. I, you know, maybe those aren't the best examples, but I just challenge us as a body not to to use this place or this bill as a political football. So I ask for your support.
Representative Kahn, on the
Yes, on the bill, I guess on the history of these bills, which Representative Lilly just went into, have there ever been non-fiscal amendments on these bills, or has the legislature ever changed the changed some of the wording of the contract as it went through the process?
Mr. Hubiger.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, under PELRA, the legislature is to approve contracts or reject them in their entirety. During the Ventura administration, the Department of Employee Relations negotiated same-sex domestic partner benefits, and that contract, those contracts were not ratified by the House. The agreement that, or the settlement that was reached over a couple-year period was to take those contracts and approve them except for the provisions that dealt or provided the same-sex domestic partner insurance benefit.
So, Madam Chair,
Representative Kahn,
I don't quite understand how that relates. Is that the equivalent then to the legislature demanding an amendment of the contracts even if it wasn't done by amendment?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, that was the way that the legislature accomplished that, yes. Was by approving the contracts except for those provisions that dealt with same-sex domestic partner insurance benefits.
Could somebody explain to me how that amounts to not amending the contracts?
Mr. Hubiger.
Madam Chair, Mr. Shepherd wrote that. It might be appropriate to talk to ask him.
Mr. Shepherd, can you clarify?
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I'd have to go back and double-check the language. My recollection, which others may correctly remember differently, is that the legislature didn't amend the contracts because a contract is an agreement between two other bodies, but I think it said that the terms and conditions of employment, it basically imposed the terms and conditions of employment by law, and it said the terms and conditions of employment would be everything that was in those contracts, except for the benefits that Mr. Hubinger referenced. Can and that's my recollection. I could be wrong. I'd have to check.
Okay.
So, for example, this would be this bill or maybe some other. Was it done at the same time as the contracts were, Mr. Shepherd, was it done at the same time as the contracts were approved?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, my recollection is that that was, yes, it was, there had been a long process during which the contracts had not been approved, and at the end of the session the agreement was that there would be a mechanism to approve everything in the contracts except that benefit. So I believe that that legislation was
okay.
Was all wrapped into one piece of legislation. Okay.
So then it might be appropriate following historical precedent to add a condition of law saying that these contracts are only approved if domestic partner benefits are included? I'm only asking procedurally. I'm not asking for a vote at this time.
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, I'm getting some help from folks who were then in the Department of Employee Relations, now MMB, who remind me that that contracts, they believe the contracts were actually renegotiated without the benefits and then approved. So the legislature just approved, ratified the contracts that had been renegotiated. I remembered incorrectly.
Okay. So we could ask to have the contracts, but they were essentially asked to do that by the legislature? They said the contract renegotiation was started by the legislature?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, I think it's a little bit hard to say who started something. I think the unions and the management recognized that it was unlikely the contracts that had originally been submitted would be ratified, so they negotiated something different that they thought would be ratified.
Okay. Thank you. Just thinking about possible future actions, Madam Chair.
Representative Crenshaw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hubinger, you had mentioned this step increases are performance-based. Is that true?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair, Representative Crenshaw, that's correct. An employee receives a step increase after they've received a performance evaluation by their supervisor, and they have to receive a rating of satisfactory or better in order to get the step increase.
Representative Crenshaw.
Follow-up question. On that, if they're performance-based, how often are they denied?
Madam Chair, Representative Crenshaw, I understand that the vast majority of the time the employee receives that satisfactory or better rating. I believe it's in the 98% range.
Representative Crenshaw.
That begs the question, of course, if they're at the 98%, aren't they almost just automatic? And it's just a question I'm going to get back in my district when I talk about this. So are they really truly performance-based or are they rubber-stamped?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Representative Crenshaw, the supervisor is required to complete a certification form indicating that the employee has performed in a satisfactory or better manner. I wouldn't want to characterize that one way or another.
Representative Crenshaw.
Okay, so then additional follow-up. If it's performance-based, why are we not doing a performance based on our top-end employees? Are they no longer held to those performance standards?
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Representative Crenshaw, an employee is required to get a performance reevaluation every year regardless of whether they're eligible for a step increase.
Mr. Crenshaw.
So then I just have to follow up. So then at some point they become proficient enough where merit pay doesn't apply to them.
Mr. Hubinger.
Madam Chair and Representative Crenshaw, an employee can only be paid at the maximum of their salary range, and so once they reach that point, they are not eligible for any additional salary increases. So they continue to work at a high level because they're at the top of the range. They just don't receive additional increases.
So then, Madam Chair,
Representative Crenshaw,
would it be fair to say that it's really, and I understand you can't characterize, but as I'm walking through the logic here, it doesn't seem to me that money is a motivation for better performance because what I would say in private enterprise aren't there to motivate people. I mean, if there's a 98%, and you don't have to answer it, I'm just following through. There's a 98% chance they're going to receive the performance, but at a certain point, they've been around long enough to where we don't incent them with money. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is really looks at it's from my district. A lot of people, you know, they ask questions like, okay, state government operates in a monopoly environment, right? As far as I know, there's no other state government. So of course we set wages and benefits. So how are these wages and benefits, how do they compare to, let's say, the private sector? And, or what do you use to set wages and benefits? What do you use And number two, how does that compare with the private sector? What research do you use, and where do we stand today in comparison? Used to be years ago. Now, I don't know how you, because I'm not on this committee, I don't know how this is always determined. But you used to know back in the 60s and 70s, and then in the 80s, there were always news articles about comparing the government wages and benefits to the private sector, and I don't hear that much. Well, actually, I do hear some of that today. But this is my only chance to really get some of these questions answered by the district. And I ask for answers to those.
Do you have that information available, Representative Lilly?
Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger, greetings. I miss you.
Nice to see you. Yep.
You just said you weren't on this committee. You and I sat together last year together right where Pierre's meat markets, right there. I mean,
right. I was on this committee, but I wasn't on the commission.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, the Taxpayer League over the last couple of years has really done a deep, in-depth study, so you could certainly look there, and that's available, and perhaps staff could hand that out at some point to members, and if the chair so desired, or you can find it yourself, certainly.
Do you have any other?
Mr. Hubinger,
well,
sorry.
Can I have a follow-up question, please?
It's after 2 o'clock.
Well, does that mean I can follow up?
Go ahead.
I'm looking for an answer on how we compare. Are we paying and our wages and our benefits higher than the private sector in comparable work? Is it lower? How is it comparable? What's the percentage? Can I get a figure?
Mr. Hubinger, do we have that information available?
Madam Chair, the Department, Minnesota Management and Budget, when they are negotiating contracts, uses data from the private sector to inform their proposals. It might be more appropriate at some point to have them talk about how they do that and how that informs the negotiations.
Representative Leidiger, do you want this information before we vote?
I'd like this information, please.
Before we vote?
Yes.
This meeting is in recess until 6:45. The State Government Finance Committee is no longer in recess, and I will call the meeting to order as we ran out of time this afternoon. Representative Leidiger was asking, we're on House File 95, and the motion is to pass the bill and send it to Ways and Means. Representative Leidiger was asking about comparisons with public and private settlements and awards that are given through the collective bargaining process. And Ms. Holmes was going to research and maybe attempt to answer Representative Ida Leidiger's pleas for understanding. And we welcome you.
Madam Chairman, my name is Barbara Holmes. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Labor Relations at MMB. I also have with me Assistant Commissioner Ann O'Brien. She's over the Human Resources area, and she is the one who's going to address the representative's questions.
Okay. Thank you. And both of you are Assistant Commissioners.
Yes.
At MMB.
Correct.
Yeah. Thank you. Ms. O'Brien.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did bring my photo. This is the first time that I am at this committee. So I have a photo of my family and my dogs, as well as my picture of me when I started state government in 1974. So that's my...
Oh, and I don't know... Mr. Nash is here. So Ms. O'Brien, or Commissioner O'Brien, has photos, and she has beautiful dogs that we can...
She does.
Compare with the other dogs that we've seen. Oh, I think Sage has competition.
That's pretty good. So.
Thank you.
And what are these dogs' names?
The dog on the right is Obi, and he's new, just from May. And the other dog is Tahi. They're both Australian Shepherds.
Now, where's the picture from when you started? Right there.
Right here.
Okay.
1974, started state government as a clerk in the Department of Revenue.
2 years before me. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we put together a flyer, as you requested, a one-page kind of summary of what are the compensation considerations that I've asked to be handed out to all of you. We do have... Minnesota statutes outlining the legislative direction in making compensation decisions. And in that, the commissioner is to ensure that we consider internal equity as a primary factor in compensation decisions. We also have requirements that require us to make sure that jobs... compensation for positions, fair relationship among jobs in similar occupations and in other private sector. The elements that are taken into consideration that we use in day-to-day managing of our classification and compensation decisions within that structure. We take the economy and the budget into consideration when we make those decisions as well. But internal equity has been a strong factor in making our decisions. The challenges that we have to making private sector comparisons in particular are that they aren't always easy to get. We do look at a variety of studies, but often comparing our jobs to private sector is difficult because we have many jobs that are not in the private sector, corrections officers, State Patrol troopers, forensic scientists, those are government types of jobs that we don't have comparisons for, as well as oftentimes private employers are reluctant to give us salary information on comparisons. We also take into consideration market when we are making initial job classification decisions. When we create job classes that are needed in state government, we look at market considerations in making those determinations. We do it through a job evaluation system where we compare what are the requirements, knowledge, skills, and abilities to do a position compared to other positions in state service, and then make those market adjustments in where we place the job on the salary range on the grids. Salary range reassignments and inequity requests, when we get either brought forward by managers, supervisors, or the unions, they would ask us to bring forward or look at salary ranges because they believe that they are inconsistent with market pressures or that we are unable to hire people due to the salary. Then we look at those job classes and those salary ranges and adjust the ranges accordingly if we feel that that's appropriate according to the market pressures. Again, taking into consideration other factors such as the budget and the economy. Salary on promotion, we look at equity in market factors when determining what to pay someone on promotion. And internal equity, so that we can make sure that those comparisons are appropriate. And then again, when units bring forward concerns about market, The bargaining units would bring that forward in the negotiation process, and we would assess through market studies at that time. I've given you a list of the common market information that we use, the studies that we use to look at for all of these factors and looking at all of these adjustments in market, and I think they're pretty self-explanatory. We are concerned about salary ranges for people. We have, the studies have shown us pretty consistently throughout the years, I'd say since about 1979, the conclusions are pretty much the same, which is that we have a competitive wage in the lower ranges and the lower job classes, lower level job classes, and we are lacking in competitiveness in our higher level and high level professional, managerial, and supervisory job classes. That's the consistent problem that we're having in attracting people in those levels. However, even when we do have market considerations, we are subject to the salary cap, which is really limits our ability to adjust those top salaries, and we do have individuals and some compression issues now. Since the salary cap has not been moved since 1998, and so we have some compression issues in our higher level jobs where we are unable to give people more than that salary cap, which is currently 95% of the governor's salary, and we're currently paying commissioners, which is the commissioner's salary, which is currently being paid approximately 89% of the governor's salary. And that's an issue that will be addressed or looked at through the Compensation Council.
Commissioner O'Brien, could you tell me what you mean by compression?
Madam Chair, the compression that we're seeing is that people are no longer able to get to the top of their salary ranges because of the limit of the salary cap. So they have reached that, and their salary stays at that level, and then that provides compression for those people below them.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Are there other questions?
Representative Leidecker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions. Let me start with some definitions. And if you'd explain a couple of the things. The market pressures over the last couple of years, and particularly the last year, for instance, what do you mean by, no, define what has occurred in the market and how much pressure has been put on salaries and benefits in order to compensate fairly. Speak to that in terms of market pressure, what you mean by it.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Holmes. Or Ms. O'Brien.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Representative. We have seen an increase in the number of people retiring in state government, as is common throughout Minnesota and the nation. And in the filling of those positions and hiring people behind those vacancies, we have seen an inability to attract and bring to state government people for salary reasons. We have several agencies and supervisors and managers who have brought to our attention that they are unable to compete with private sector in particular, but in more and more local units of government salaries that they couldn't get elsewhere. So I would say that those are some of the market pressures that I was referring to. But when we look at a market analysis, we take those issues into consideration and we can't always adjust them to the market pressures, adjust the salary ranges to those pressures. We look at what is also internal equity within the state government to make sure that we aren't creating more problems and compression problems.
Representative Leidecker.
Do you do you take into consideration applications? Do you track that, applications for open billets? And is that increased over the last 2 years or decreased? And I realize it's I realize there's, we're talking 25,000 jobs, and that there's certainly different differing levels. But in general, and of course, what I'm driving to is with the higher unemployment that we've had, one would think that we're getting far more applications for our, for the state government positions, which in fact should really alleviate some of the pressure. Do you track that?
Commissioner O'Brien.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do process approximately 7,000 requisitions for positions every year and have in the last several years. We have seen an increase in the number of applicants who apply for state positions. We also have had, as a reduction in our force, we have had more specific qualifications for positions than we had in previous years. So we are hiring mostly for specific technical or professional skills. And while we have had an increase in the number of applicants for positions, we have had a decrease in the number of qualified applicants for positions.
Representative Leidecker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The overall compensation from, and once again, I understand the various different positions, but the what on governing.com, for instance, they talk about a decrease in the private sector compensation at almost 3%. While our state government is increasing by, what is that, 2.16%, something like that, when you include the benefits as well as wages. How do you rationalize increases in wages, and in particular, which is really the rub, without participation of a government employee in the healthcare, putting any skin in the game in healthcare, how do you rationalize that difference when private sector wages are going down at that kind of level, and yet state government continues to increase, and yet not have any participation in the system, in the healthcare system?
Commissioner Holmes.
Madam Chair, again, this is Barbara Holmes, representative. One of the things that's difficult to do is to just say state government jobs and compare them with the market. The market has so many other sectors, and so if they're decreasing, I don't know if we can say that those are for comparable jobs where they're decreasing. It may in fact be some, but sometimes generalizing doesn't help a lot. Now, it's true that under the negotiated agreements that employees are not contributing to the premium cost for their health insurance, that doesn't mean they aren't paying some of the costs. They pay almost, under these agreements, on average an employee will pay $1,000 when you start looking at first dollar deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance. So it's not only is it important to look at the whole package, but it's there's some detail in that health insurance coverage that gets lost sometimes.
Representative Leidecker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure, were you here when Representative Purcell had discussed that, well, it really doesn't make any difference that employees don't pay anything for health insurance because we're going to go to a single-payer system anyway. Do you share that same opinion, that it doesn't matter?
It's irrelevant.
Madam Chair, isn't... I don't know that that's...
Well,
Madam Chair and Representative Leidecker, I don't know that that's fair questioning. I mean, I'd ask you to reconsider and come up with a better question, perhaps.
Well...
Representative Leidecker.
And I'll do that, Madam Chair. And here's the thing. We know that by making healthcare into a single payer system, it makes it a non-competitive system. We know that when you take competition out of a health, and I'm going on to healthcare, talking about healthcare a little bit.
Well, Madam Chairman, and Representative Kahn, it's hardly relevant to the discussion. Healthcare is a single payer system, of which I can go on for hours about it, since I actually have my kids and grandkids are actually in the Montreal government system, and I can go on for hours about how good that is compared to what we have here. But the it's not really relevant to the state contracts.
Well, I'll jump right to the point. The point is here we are not having our government employees put anything into it. I mean, zero payment when it's going in the exact opposite direction that the private sector in many of the other states are doing, such as Wisconsin. I mean, the state goes into the wrong direction in which it is totally unsustainable in the future. And I want to understand the rationale in the government's position, our government's position behind that, and how we can negotiate zero skin in the game.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe I heard earlier that as part of these agreements, the contracts, the employees are going to be contributing greater co-pays at the doctor office, greater they negotiated cost savings into the healthcare part of it. So the employees do have a greater skin in the game, and whether you consider that a benefit, it's to me, the way I look at it in the world I come out of, it's total compensation, and we talk total compensation. Mm-hmm. And what you get for your health insurance, what the employer pays, that's part of the compensation you get. And if you're putting more money in, so you're actually taking a deduction in what you get in total compensation, if you're having to pay higher deductibles, higher co-pays, because it's more money out of your pocket when you go to the doctor, if you go to the doctor. So you're actually taking a deduction in your compensation. So, I mean, when you're talking this, you're saying we're giving this to them. We're not giving them anything. This is part of their compensation package, that if we wanted to go to just, say, get rid of health care and give them the dollars that we pay that on their checks and want to go buy their own health insurance, that would be a way to go also. But to say that they don't have any skin in the game, it seems ridiculous to me, because it's part of their compensation package. And if they're having to pay higher deductibles at the doctor office, they're taking a deduction in their pay, and they actually have more skin in the game. As was said earlier in this afternoon, that these people have more skin in the game.
Commissioner Holmes. Oh, you were.
I'm Madam Chairman. I'm not sure if there was a question. It's just again, yes, we have in this contract, these contracts before you, they all have increases in what employees would pay for the annual first dollar deductible, co-pays for office visits, co-pays for emergency care, co-pays for inpatient hospital care, co-pay for outpatient surgery, in an increase in co-insurance amounts for lab, pathology, x-rays, MRIs, an increase in the out-of-pocket non-drug maximum expense, and an increase in the prescription co-pay amount.
Commissioner, do you have any figures on the numbers of people, of the public employees that don't participate then because the amount that they have to contribute before they can get onto the insurance, where they refuse to go to the doctor then when they should? Do you have any figures on that?
Madam Chair, not that I'm aware of. It's difficult to prove a negative. There might be some comparisons to make across time, but I'm not sure of that.
Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to bring to the attention of the committee the conclusions on page 10 of this fact sheet that we got.
Some people don't have it.
Oh, okay. I think it was sent out. What it says is that state employees earn less wages and receive less in compensation, including all benefits, than comparable private sector employees. So that's including benefits. And for those of us who have served in the military, you know, we accepted lower pay for things like early retirement and health care. And I think that this applies also to our state employees, that even though they're not receiving as much as their civilian counterparts, they're doing it, you know, because they've got the long-term benefits from being state employees.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's an interesting discussion. I think everyone on the committee, every member has a right to ask questions and scrutinize and all the rest. I just thought we should remind ourselves, especially those who were on the committee last time, when we received the last workforce development report from the state, we have fewer people working for the state of Minnesota now than we did in 2001. Let me repeat that. Fewer bodies, fewer people than over 10 years ago. So I just hope we keep this all in perspective. Not that every member has a right to scrutinize whether this is a good deal or a bad deal, but this idea of this irrepressible blob that keeps growing is just simply not true. It's not a fact. So I just hope we can get that straight. Fewer employees now than we had 10 years ago. Fewer.
And population has increased.
Right. I just ask that we keep that in perspective.
Thank you for that reminder. Representative Leidiger.
Well, and if it's okay, I'd like to just address that a little bit. I mean, we should have less people with the huge investment that we have made over the many years on the technology, which equates to force multipliers. I mean, this is it allows people to be able to do more with a lot less. In other words, you should be able to reduce the numbers of people. And even though the population, yes, has risen over time, but you know, the state of Minnesota has also become the largest employer in the state by far, with the federal government being the second largest. The private sector has been reduced by the number one employer is Mayo Foundation and then Target Corporation. I mean, in the top five employers in the state, only three earn the private sector. Now, 30 years ago, it was the exact opposite. In fact, in the top five employers were all private sector employers. Government has grown enormously over that time, and certainly has outpaced our private sector. And we've got to keep that in mind, I think. Now, the question that I had asked earlier was. Let's look at our position, the government's position, in its negotiations, and when comparing our compensation with the private sector. And I realize it was a difficult request. I thought we would have something a little bit more detailed than what we have here, but I don't see it. I don't see her answer as really saying, Representative Newman, that government employees make considerably less than. Yeah, this is the piece I hadn't seen.
Yeah, you can have that. I have a one here as
well. Well, in this answer, it doesn't state that. In fact, it's different. It's difficult to glean exactly where the state does stand, but when you compare it to some of the private information that I was able to find on the internet, we're clearly widening the gap between government employee compensation and private sector compensation to a tune of about 5% just over the last biennium. And if you just look at that alone, it's of concern. And it's certainly of great concern out in my district. This is one of the biggest topics is, you know, government employees don't have to, you know, put skin in the game. They're getting their increases, and we are hurting. And to go back to the people, this is a difficult thing to go back and say, well, this is the reason why. Well, consistently comparisons are incomplete. So I go back and I say, the data is incomplete. I guess we're just gonna throw a. And I realize it's difficult to negotiate. I've had to negotiate contracts in the past as well. But our rationale and justification, in my view, is weak. And how we come up with our position, the government's position, when competing with its, negotiating with its employees, especially with the backdrop of what's going on out in the private sector, and especially with the huge arguments going on with the healthcare system. So I don't think we're complete. I find it shallow in stating the government's position in our negotiations.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to add to the lively discussion, but I know that 2 years ago when I started work on this and was selected for that, one of the studies that we used was commissioned by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I know, in fact, I have the report in front of me that it was the Minnesota Taxpayers Association who did the policy research. And I know this is a couple years old now, but the study was lengthy. It was 2001 to 2009. And they matched private sector with state where they had occupation codes, to do that federally. And they did. They looked at 9,400 state positions representing 41 occupations. And I won't read you the local ones. I'll just stick with the state. But this is their findings. Minnesota pays state employees above average when compared to other states. On a nominal basis, state employees were paid $59,450 on average, seventh highest in the nation. On a cost of living adjusted basis, state employees were paid at $57,797 on average, fifth highest in the nation. Wages are higher than private sector counterparts. Now, these would be in the occupation codes, but this is a pretty large study, 9,400, individuals, working for the state. Now, counterparts in 24 of 41 occupations are 72%. And I would agree with you that expecting our executive level, and I think we heard today that we're significantly underpaying many of our lawyers and some of the people to executive. And I kind of wonder sometimes if we can attract the best and the brightest if we have caps that are, based on elected positions. I think we all know that we're going to take less when we run for it. Nobody twisted our arm. But the fact is, this study does indicate that in the lower levels where the bulk of our positions are, that in 24 of the 41 occupations that we're paying more. And I'm not going to cite, this is a done deal. Everybody knows how this is all going to turn out in the end, but I think it needs to go on the record that there's more than one study. I wish if we were going to bring studies tonight, maybe we all could have got a copy of that study, and that would have been helpful. But nevertheless, I have a study in front of me that you can all look at yourselves. It's online that kind of says something completely the opposite. And I think that the concern being expressed on this side of the table, or this side of the aisle, so to speak, is more of being responsible. And, we all ran and got election certificates. You all ran, got election certificates. I have many public employees, state employees that work. I have a district garage for the MDOT, in my district. I appreciate the hard work that they do. I just also appreciate, how we've asked our taxpayers, and I know state employees are taxpayers. Won't make that mistake. Another Benson may have done that once, but this one won't.
Don't fall for that.
No. But the fact is, we do need to be responsible, and I think all you're hearing is a little bit of, could have, woulda, shoulda, in terms of maybe getting a little direction from the
the Relations Committee. And now it's past that. That's committee's passed it on, and we're here. But I think for the record, that there is more than one study that shows that we're not shortchanging our state employees. And just to make that statement. And don't need, if you want to comment on it, you're more than welcome. You have the microphone. You just ask the Madam Chair for that time.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and I don't know if you can answer this or not, but where my concern comes from is employees, state employees that have statewide jurisdiction. And we've got, you know, in multitude of places, we've got people that are in our regulatory agencies that have statewide jurisdictions, but yet they have private businesses that also enter into contracts that otherwise would have been done by the state. And I have concerns about when they do those contracts, and if they make a mistake, who's liable? Where does that liability rest? And the other part of that then is there are contracts when they enter into that contract with that for that job that otherwise that job would have been done by state, and they're taking money out of the state coffers. So my question is that addressed anywhere in our contracts? And if not, when should it be, and when does that liability get adjusted?
Commissioner,
and I could be specific, ma'am, if you need me to be.
Commissioner Holmes?
Madam Chair, Representative, I have to admit I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about, absent some more specifics, but there are provisions in the contract. We do have the right as state government to subcontract certain types of work, and other types of work that are done by employees, there are some restrictions on our ability to subcontract, and there is some language in the labor contracts. But you're getting at a liability issue that is well beyond what the state labor contract controls.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm if I work for the Department of Labor and Industry, and I've got my own personal consulting business, and I go out and contract with, let's say, a hypothetically, an ice arena or something to that effect up in Bemidji, and I personally contract with that outside of the state, even though I'm a state employee, and I do something, and I miss something. And we're all human. We all miss stuff. And that creates a liability on that ice arena that's missed. Now, in actuality, where that would be done, if that was a private contractor, where that would come, that's under his jurisdiction as a state employee. So if it would have been an outside employee that did that, it would be reviewed by him. But now he made the mistake, and it's coming to get his review because he'd be the guy representing the state to fix it. So that's where I come into, where does that liability fall, and how can we allow our state employees that have statewide jurisdiction conduct that type of a business?
Commissioner Holmes.
Madam Chair, Representative Howe, there are rules that govern what a state employee can do in their private capacity, and if there is a conflict of interest between what they're trying to do outside of their state job and what they're doing for the state, that is not allowed. It sounds like possibly something is happening there, and if you would like to talk about it in more detail, to give us some detail about where this is happening, we'd like to know that, because that would be a problem, and we do have those situations, and we discipline people, or we make them make a decision about which job they want to have.
Representative Huff.
I would love to have that conversation, because actually I know it in multiple state agencies that is being conducted. So if that's in the contracts, who's enforcing the contracts? because I can tell you that there's, and I can give you examples offline, but and names if you'd like them. But we've got multiple instances of that occurring with the commissioners of those agencies' blessings and full knowledge.
Commissioner Holmes, will you follow up on that with Representative House, please?
I will follow up, and just so you know, that the provisions that govern conflict of interest that I'm talking about are not in the labor contracts but are in state law, and I will follow up with you about your concerns. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to speak to the issue of the study report that Representative Benson referenced relative to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. And I understand that, according to that study, although I have not seen it, that state employees are paid more than typical in other states. And I haven't seen the studies, but I believe that Minnesota, as a state in the private sector, is also paid much more typically than many other states on an average. So if you look at that particular study out of context, it might seem egregious and unusual, but if you look at it in context of the private sector and the public sector together, I believe that we'd find that it's probably somewhat normal.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Leidiger.
Just in, I think that's a very good point, and I applaud you on that. However, the studies clearly show a division of what's going on in terms of what's being paid to the private sector and what is being paid to state government. And so I want to refer back to that divide of about 5% per year. And actually, I'm not sure if it's 5% per year or whether it's 5% per biennium. The idea there is, as the private sector's compensation goes down, states is going up, there is a divide. So yes, understand that we are a higher paid state in the private sector. We are in government. But what's happening, who's getting the bacon? Certainly it's not the private sector. And I'm not also saying, you know, I'm not saying that the government employees don't deserve to make more, but I don't think you have to answer to your constituents when they come up to you and say, I'm losing money in my business. I had to shut down my business, or I had to take a pay cut in my job, and I have to, and my health care is 25% more than it used to be. And they're going to read in the paper that, well, state government employees are getting 2%. They don't have to pay anything in for their health care. And then you start reading the history of the increases that they've had over the years. And then they start reading about the divide. And they say, well, how did you vote on that? You know, your department probably doesn't have to answer that, but we're answering that out in our districts. All of us are. And in some districts, like Representative Kahn's and others that maybe have a high concentration of public sector workers, they're applauding. Because there's a pay raise. And in others, areas around the state, they're saying, what the heck is going on? Why can't government follow, see what's going on in the economy, and let's follow that way? You know, didn't we just hear this past week that that there's no growth in our economy over the fourth quarter? Well, what is it when, I don't know what it takes to get a double-dip recession. Is it two quarters in a row of negative growth? I think it's two quarters. We already have one under our belt. Are we going into a double-dip recession? I hope not. But that's what the people are seeing, and we're here to represent the people and do the right thing. And then... What really set me off earlier was when Representative Purcell talks about, well, doesn't matter because we're kind of all going to go towards single payer system eventually, and that's just going to be that way. And you know, we're government's a monopoly. There isn't another government we have to compete with. So we can do what we want. I'm not sure we always do the right thing. I'm done.
Representative Dean? Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, thank you. I can't resist because when the economic news came out about the slight contraction of the U.S. economy, it was immediately followed by the reasons. All the economists agreed that the reasons for that unexpected slight contraction was decreased government spending, particularly in the area of military spending. So when government cuts back and we go to austerity, it has a real-world economic effect. And just as Representative Benson, you're right, public workers are taxpayers. They're also spenders, and they buy stuff. And just like you and me, it's amazing. And as one pundit said, both parties' talking points got screwed up. Democrats were saying, see, things are getting better, and that got screwed up by the fourth quarter report. But Republicans' talking points were also mixed up a little bit because the reason overwhelmingly was decreased government spending, particularly when it came to the defense budget.
Representative Leidinger.
There's just that there's a difference in microeconomics and macroeconomics. We'll see what the next quarter brings.
Well. Phyllis, let it go.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as Representative Simon pointed out, I read those reports too, and the decrease in the fourth quarter was a lot to do with fear around the fiscal cliff and what was going to happen with that and fear of the cuts in military spending, so that was going down. But I also listened to on CCO Radio this weekend when they have their money market guy on there that talks about, and he said he doesn't see in the forecast a double-dip recession. He sees growth in the next year to 18 months. So, I mean, when we want to talk about this, we're all projecting what's out there. All we've been talking about has nothing to do with passing this contract bill and getting this bill taken care of.
Representative Kahn.
Just a comment, if you want to really look at predictors of the economy and so forth, the stock market hit its highest point in I don't know what period of time. So those are the people, the financial analysts are the ones who are making their judgment about where the economy is going, and their judgment is it's going up.
So it seems like apparently we have more time than I thought. I'm just going to read the last paragraph of this report on the second page. There's plenty more, but total compensation, state government, 2001 to 2009, total state government employee compensation, wages, employer pension contributions, and health care grew at an average annual rate 35% faster than the state's own revenues. Okay, 4.6% versus 3.4. If recent compensation trends continue, revenues will have to grow at about 18% faster than long-term forecasts predict. Otherwise, compensation costs could run the risk of crowding out other areas of government spending or forcing a downsizing of the workforce relative to population. From a total compensation cost perspective, employer costs for wages, health care, and pensions, 71.7% of employees included in the study have a total compensation cost that are at least 5% greater than private sector counterparts. Oh, I'll conclude. Thank you.
Commissioner O'Brien.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I need to state that we are fully understanding the taxpayer report, and we have reviewed it and looked at it. And we believe that they studied 40 occupational categories, and we have 1,800 occupational categories in state government. The report does state that it excluded supervisors, managerials, and high-level professionals from their studies because they are consistently, in their words, underpaid for the work. So while the overall conclusion on the lower portion of the job classes that they studied was that they were competitive with other job classes in the other public sector and private sector, but that our primary focus on the higher level jobs were not competitive and were lower than the rest. So I just needed to state that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Representative Lilly?
I think there
Representative
might be.
Representative Wills.
Did you want to go first?
I was hoping to close it out, but you can.
I just had kind of an overall question, if that's all right, Madam Chair. Representative Lilly, I saw on the page that says state employee salary settlements, the fiscal year 2012-2013 estimated costs, that for the percentage increase for biennium to biennium, it's 4.92%. And I was just curious what the dollar amount would be on that. And then I had a follow-up question based on that.
Representative Lilly.
This is the handout from earlier today.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hubinger gave me this pretty...
It's the one that says...
Pretty good thing today, but I think I'll have Ms. Holmes answer it at this point, and then I'll look for this other form that I can't seem to find. Oh, here. Well, go ahead.
The last page.
Madam Chair, Representative, the biennial new money that these contracts that are before you would add for this biennium is, now it's in very tiny print, is... Oh, this is embarrassing. It's about 78 or 76 million. I think you can read that column of what's attached. And the projections, of course, since the 2% just goes into effect for the last 6 months of this contract period, the full impact of that 2% is felt in the next biennium, and the total cost for these contracts in the next 14-15 biennium is estimated to be about $249 million.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then follow-up question on that. I know that you said that the pension liability is not addressed in these contracts, but I guess I'm just curious what is being done to address the liabilities if we're continuing to add debt on that. So that's a concern of mine.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
the cost of the retirement benefits is included in this amount, okay? But you're correct. We do not negotiate pension contributions or the system, and that is overseen by the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, and I think that question would be better addressed to them or if there's a member on this committee that's also on that commission.
Okay. I guess just a follow-up comment, if I may. I really appreciate all the information and the discussion that's been going back and forth, and just wanted to say that I hope that we can have a good communication between both groups as we're looking at adding new budget cost and also dealing with liabilities. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to thank you all for the discussion. You know, we've had an interesting path, and we're going to continue from here, hopefully, to, you know, if you guys approve it tonight, to Ways and Means and then to the House floor. And these contracts have been negotiated in good faith between the MMB and our state employees. And it's been a kind of a long haul, and it's time... I just kind of want to apologize. You know, it's been brought up about the reports, and I did hand out a report, but I didn't want to get into like a report war that can often happen in this place. So I didn't really. It was more of background information. So my apologies. You know, if some information was taken, and I mentioned your report earlier, and I just didn't. You know, I just didn't want to get into that. So that was. I'm the guilty party on that. Comparables are hard on these contracts. It's you know, it's interesting. There's a few here that, you know, with their jobs in the federal government might have lifetime health care. I happen to work for a Minnesota company that's going to give me lifetime flight benefits. I would imagine some of our employees might want that. that's kind of a nice thing. You know, just keep in mind, no one's really getting rich, you know, with these contracts. I got to admit that when I started on the city council, you know, I've kind of looked at some of your resumes, some of your others too, and I was a lot more conservative. And I just remember my time there that after a while you realize that, you know, the These people are out keeping us safe while we're sleeping. They're fixing our power lines. In my case, we have a public utility. You know, I had a friend that was a police officer that was killed, you know, Officer Crittenden. And, you know, just like Ernie and I used to, you know, bump elbows and then give each other a hard time. I mean, it was the same with Officer Crittenden, and, you know, he's gone. But so, you know, I guess I have a little, you know, more compassion. Not compassion, that's not fair. I just have a different feeling on the public employees, perhaps. One of the things that's interesting, as I've been on this committee, is that these are really negotiated with the governor, and now we have an election coming up in the 14, and, you know, my hockey buddy, Tim Pawlenty, you know, his contracts, there was a lot in there I didn't really like, and I carried those bills at one time, maybe Representative Leidiger wants to run for governor, and that'd probably be a good way to change that, perhaps. I don't know, but, does he play hockey? I don't know. But, you know, the folks that I've experienced here, they've got, you know, good answers, you know, to these honest questions that you're asking. And, again, I appreciate the dialogue. And I just hope that we can pass this forward. These folks have been waiting a long time. They do good work for all of us. And I hope we can treat them with respect. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Thank you, Commissioner Holmes, Commissioner O'Brien. Appreciate that you came this evening and answered the questions from the discussion. Appreciate the good discussion that we've had this evening. Mr. Hubiger, thank you very much for your service on this bill. And is there anyone in the audience that came that's here to testify for or against? If not, I renew my motion that House File 95, first engrossment, be recommended to pass. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
The motion is adopted and the bill will be sent to Ways and Means.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members.
Madam Commissioner, I do have, or Madam Chair, I do have a picture. Would you like to see it?
I would.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Since we're talking about public employees, I wanted to share with you who my very favorite public employee was. My late husband was Roger Holt, public employee, was. My late husband was Roger Holmes. I think that Representative Kahn and perhaps Representative Murphy, you're familiar with him. He worked for the Department of Natural Resources for 41 years. He was the Fish and Wildlife Director at the end of his career. He retired in 2000. While he was working, he received many, many awards at the state, national, international level. And then even after he retired, he continued to get awards, much to his surprise. The most significant award is shown in this picture here. He had a 1,000-acre wildlife management area out in Douglas County named for him. That was an incredible honor, and this picture here is he and I in front of that. Unfortunately, he passed away in 2008 from prostate cancer. On this Saturday evening, I had the honor of accepting, along with his two sons, he was inducted into the Minnesota Waterfowl Association Hall of Fame, and so that's what I have to share with you.
And my predecessor, Willard Munger, just had great regard for Roger Holmes. So thank you for reminding us of his great contributions to the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative
Swatsky. Honey, you never
Swatsky.
Put names together.
Madam President,
Chair.
I'm sorry, that was a little emotional. I'm sorry about that. I would cut off. Madam Chair, I move that the minutes from the committee meeting on January 3rd, 2013, be approved.
Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of approval of the minutes as printed, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
The motion is adopted. The next meeting will be at our regular time on Wednesday. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.